This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Like usual, I have really a fantastic guest again, somebody that I know for many, many years now. He worked for the organization that I work for presently, and he's now also a board member on the board of the organization I work for. And I would like, as usual, to ask him to introduce himself. Sophie.
Yes, my name is Vi Nguyen. And I'm with Wicked Compassion. It is the mission fund of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ for Relief, Refugee, and Sustainable Development. We have been around for over 7 decades, working with ecumenical partners domestically and globally to respond to some of the most vulnerable communities that experience from economic disaster, natural disaster, human-made disasters.
Okay. And can you tell our audience a little bit, how did you get involved in this work?
I have always been interested in the global community. I think part of it is because of my background, growing up in Vietnam and then having to flee Vietnam due to the conflict in the Southeast Asia region in the 60s and 70s. And just encountering so many people from different tradition, different background, different faith, has always been a calling for me to return to working with the global community. And at the same time, my faith has always been important to me as well, to help me understand what it is that is needed to make a difference in our world.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Vi. So how old were you when you came to the United States?
I just turned 8 when I came to the United States as a refugee. Many people in Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s fled Vietnam because of the war. And then the Vietnam government shut down the country after the fall of Saigon in 1975. And not many people could. My father worked for the United States government during the time, during the war, and he was put in concentration camp after the war because of his involvement with the United States government. After he was released from the government, he attempted multiple times to escape because his future in the country was very limited and the condition that was put on him and his family. And so he decided to take me with him. We fled. We lived in refugee camps for several years and then arrived in the United States when I just turned 8.
Hmm. And did you have, brothers and sisters who you left behind, who you had to leave behind, and your mom? How did that go?
Yes, there was definitely family separation because of safety. In the first wave, what they learned, in the first wave, a lot of people who left, they left by helicopter or by planes. In the second wave, which was after 1975, millions of Vietnamese, South Asian refugees fled by boat, and it was dangerous. Thousands of people died. And what they learned from that is that you don't want to put everything in the basket. You don't want to take all of your family in the first try because it was so risky. If something were to happen, it would basically hurt the whole family. And so my dad and other refugees hundreds of thousands of refugees, what they decided to do was to take on that first journey alone or take one other member with them. Once they arrive in a safe place like the United States or France or Australia, they can begin the process of reuniting their family by sponsoring them. And so we were separated from our family for many years. There were hundreds of thousands of other refugees who were separated from their families. This is a very common story during this time where you didn't want to risk losing your entire family. And so once you make it to safety, you begin the process of reunification. And of course, there's a lot of, for a kid, you know, at that age, that young age, I think of my son right now, who is 5 years old. At this time, you know, when I was five, I was in a refugee camp. And now he's five. I'm thinking through what he's thinking, what I remember at that time, what he will remember during this time. There was a lot of family separation, a lot, some families. I remember in refugee camps, there were kids who were under 18 and they left on their own and they were in the camp and it was really difficult for them. I remember it was just my dad and I, and we didn't have any other family members in the camp. And so we connected with other family members in the refugee camp to support one another. And so that was my experience growing up.
And so you were able to get reunited with your family, and if so, do you still remember, you know, if you think back about that moment, what happened with you? How did that feel?
Yes, we were physically able to get reunited together, but we were separated from one another for, I want to say, almost 10 years. And it was hard. The psychological impact, being able to reflect on this now, looking back to what happened back then, you know, the psychological impact on my whole family, for a lot of family, was just so hard. Even though we were able to be reunited physically, it was just so hard to be together. Part of it is because, you know, we know it now as a PTSD. My dad, you know, fought in the war along with the United States government. And so there was a lot of trauma that was involved with that. And so when we were able to sponsor my whole family, my sisters, my brothers, and my mom to come to the United States, while we were able to be together physically, there was a lot of psychological wound that needed to be dealt with. That's why now, to this day, what we have learned from, not just from my experience, but just from many people's experiences, that psychological impact plays a major role long after the conflict is over. Even though you might be able to get family safely to the United States or somewhere, you know, the journey, the experience, the conflict that they encounter, is the wound that they have gathered is deeply ingrained. And that in itself is also important to deal with. Well, back then I was just a kid, you know, my family didn't know anything about this stuff, and it was just really hard. All of that is to say that war, conflict, anything that separates family have a dramatic impact mentally, psychologically, spiritually to people. And that component as well is really important to help support. The physical aspect is really important. But the mentor is long and deep.
And no, thanks for sharing that, Vy. And how you know, is it something that you try to incorporate it in the work then of the organization that you work for at the moment, you know, the mental aspects? Because I know Week of Compassion is an organization that tries to support people in, you know, who are living in difficult circumstances, both within the country as outside, right? So yeah, how do you use your experience in the programs you know, that you support?
Yeah, and it's not just me too. I mean, we've learned a lot, you know, mm-hmm. the work that we do, not just Uyghur Compassion, but many of our global ecumenical partners have learned a lot, the importance of psychological support. You know, this pandemic this past year is going to have a long-term trauma, psychological trauma, spiritual trauma on many individuals and families. And that is something that we continue to address, to figure out how do we support local communities even after this pandemic is over, because the scar is going to be there. It's going to affect how we relate to one another, how we live our life. And it is something that is easily dismissible because we don't see it. We don't realize it until long after. But we have learned a lot too. And so it's important for us to really support mental health for many of our communities that we serve here domestically and globally. And so that is something that we really intentionally, more so than ever, to make sure that we address in many of the responses that we have.
Hmm. Thanks, Dee. Yeah, I would like to make a small little jump to you know, the reason why this particular podcast you know, started to exist. You know, it has to do with 9 years ago when I decided to walk in a week 100 miles to raise money and awareness around poverty and hunger. If you would be asked to walk 100 miles, you know, for what cause or what reason would you walk 100 miles? Not 100 miles.
You know, I remember that, yes, it was 9 years ago, huh? When you came out here to the West Coast in California and you did your 100 mile, and I was able to be a part of that. I walk a little bit of that with you. You know, walking 100 miles, it seems hard. I mean, but if you think about it, like, life is a journey. How many miles have we walk together, not just, you know, with the people that we accompany with, but the people that we encounter, and how many of those miles did we get to choose to walk versus so many people who are displaced, who are displaced by violence or by disasters, who don't get to choose to walk 100 miles, who are forced to flee, to run, leave everything behind, where they don't know how many miles. It could be more than 100 miles. I mean, at least, you know, I think the concept of doing a 100 mile walk helped us to think about, to reorientate some of the values and the things that we do daily. What are the things that are important, that we get to choose this? We get to say, yes, I can wake up and do this walk. Whereas not many people get to wake up and choose to do a walk, but that it may be their whole life they are forced to walk. Sometimes that journey for them doesn't end. We know that millions of refugees have been refugees for decades, that their journey is not over. They don't have a final destination. And so that yearly walk that you did, Maurice, that you continue to do, is inspiring, because every year it's that time of year, it reminds me of, you know, all the work that I do is important. Remember why it is important. This 100 mile walk is the time to really reflect, recenter our life, to recenter our work, to reclaim the importance of our work. And that is, you know, to accompany the so many people out there who don't get the chance to choose the journey, but the journey is forced on them. Mm.
Yeah, thanks for lifting that up, Fee. I think that's really important. I would also use this opportunity to ask our listeners, if they haven't listen to the episode that I did with Isabella Alexander, who had made an incredible movie about, you know, the journey of many North Africans to Europe and the struggles they go through, which, you know, she highlights and she shows many of those issues that you just mentioned, you know, including the mental health, the time that people 10 to 15 years, if not longer, of their lives have to spend time in camps or on the road. So, I mean, it's, Fia, I don't know how you feel about it. We are facing many challenges at the moment, and COVID, of course, is a big one. But the way I try to, you know, to work myself through this period is, you know, we are now 9-10 months into this pandemic. You know, you, my parents, you know, they experienced for many, many years a hardship. So 9 months, you know, being in front of my computer with internet is, I'm not saying it is easy, you know, it's, but reminding myself is that many, many other people are under, I think, have to live under many more difficult circumstances, you know, helps me to, you know, to stay positive and to work, continue to work me through myself through this. So, thanks for lifting that up. I know personally that, you know, faith is very important for you, V. Actually, when, you know, you have accompanied me twice for a couple of days, you know, initially when I was walking in California and more recently in Indonesia as well. Well, you know, when you do these walks, that is also a time of reflection. And often I end up talking with my fellow walkers about, you know, what drives you in life, what's the purpose and religion and faith. I would like to ask you a couple of questions around youth, the younger generation, although, again, you have to be careful with generalizing. But what is your take on the younger generation and their faith and, you know, spirituality in religion? Is that different according to you than, you know, if you compare it with the older generation? What do you see that is happening in the US and around the globe?
You know, I think the youth and the younger generations, I mean, I'm at a crossroads, right? I feel like I'm no longer a young adult, but I'm not, you know, whatever that other term opposite of a young adult is. I'm at a crossroads with that. But I think, I mean, there's so much energy, there's so much commitment to justice in the young adults. Then, I mean, I think there's something about being a young adult and caring deeply for when you see something is wrong in society and doing something about it and wanting to make a change for it. It is so powerful. The youth now have more information than at any given point in our history, right? The internet has given them so much access to whatever is happening around the community and all over the world. But also, I mean, it has in some way connected them too through social media, videos, so many out there that help them to be able to mobilize, to organize change in a ways that I've never seen before. And so, you know, I think the energy is just off the chart. And I hope it continues that way. My concern is that I hope they never lose that, because it's so easy to lose that energy, to lose that ability to really see that the world can be better than what it is right now, that we don't have to accept it the way it is, that that, you know, it shouldn't be this way if it's not fair for everyone, if there's no justice. They don't have to conform to a system, but I think if the system is flawed, change that. So I think that is just powerful. In terms of faith, I think in some ways, you know, they have a sense of a higher calling, meaning I feel like they do, it's not just one day that woke up and decided to, you know, oh, there's something wrong with the world. I think there's something in them that compels them to get up, to fight for the injustice, to get out and protest, to get out and serve their community, to volunteer at a local food bank, to go and work with an international relief organization, to go inside the refugee camps. I think in some ways they are very religious, maybe not the traditional sense of religion, but there's a higher calling to doing this, that we as human beings are connected to one another, and that we need to make sure that all of us are striving, that when some communities are impacted, all of us are impacted, that we are called to get on our knees and wash each other's feet so that we can continue on this long journey of life, so that we can bend the arc of the universe towards justice. Mm.
Can you maybe explain and then how Week of Compassion, you know, tries to connect with the younger generation? And are there certain things that you need to do differently than what you have done maybe in the past?
You know, I think the operational things that we do, there's programs, things that we support, but I think it's really spending as much time as we can with as many people, as many youth as we can. I think all of us are trying to figure out what it means for us to connect with young adults, to connect with them in a way that is long-term and sustaining and impactful. I think for Week of Compassion, it is something that we have always tried to do, and it's something that we are still trying to figure out, because within the young adults, I think there's something about that view of it doesn't always have to be this way, which I love. In the work that we do, it doesn't always have to be, you know, the way that it's been done. And when you engage in young adults on a regular basis, you are consistently reminded that, you know, you need to ask that question. Does it need to be this way? Can there be a different way? Have we tried it yet? If not, why can't we try it? All of that is to say that we are always intentionally trying to ask the same questions, to not forget those questions that many of our young adults ask us or want us to ask, and to try to make sure that that, you know, that the work that we're doing is very involving of young adults.
Okay. What are some of the things that you worry about at the moment?
I don't know. I think one of the things that we are not worried about, right? I think there's so much, I worry about the refugees in the camps and what happened this past year with migration, how more countries locked up their borders and refugees couldn't flee in some of the areas, how the number of refugees continue to skyrocket, how conflict continues to reshape communities all over the world. About, you know, the United States, what's going to happen in the future. What role does the United States play around the world? What role does faith communities play? I worry, you know, about climate change. How, I live in California. This 2020, this past year, was the worst fire we've ever had in our history. But the last several years, we have said that for every single year. I do not look forward to the next fire season this summer or the next several years. We haven't had much rain here this winter. Drought is another big issue. All of that is to say, I have a lot to worry. I think we all do. But I'm also hopeful too. I mean, I'm hopeful that, you know, because of so much that's happening, so much conflict, so much heaviness that we all carry, that it's going to force us to work even faster, to work even more together, to find a solution, solve some of this problem. If we don't do that, it's going to get worse. And so I have a lot to worry about, but I'm also hopeful too. And it's 2021. It's a new year. Mm-hmm. It has to be more hopeful.
Great. You have any last message for the listeners, V?
What a crazy way to start 2021. But it's just the very beginning of 2021. There's many more months, days, hours ahead of us to continue to shape this year in a way that we see how we see the world should be. There's a lot of work ahead of us. That's a lot of opportunities for us to reshape, to rebuild the community that we want to have, the world that we want to have. And so be hopeful, be engaged, be energized.
Thanks, Thea. I have one more question, which I call the bonus question. If I would ask you to mention a song that embodies, for a big part, what you are about, which song would that be?
You know, I'm not really... The sad thing about my life is, as I live through my son at his age, and he loves music right now. He loves musical, and he loves singing. And I, you know, my life journey as a kid, we didn't have music. But for me, I chose the flute growing up, and I started playing the flute all the way through high school and college and after that. And for me, you know, there's something about sound, about instrument in the symphony. One of my favorite symphonies is Mahler Symphony Number 9, a symphony of 1,000. The reason why that one is so important for me is not many orchestras play that symphony often, because it takes a lot of players, a choir. It's literally a symphony of 1,000 because there's so many people that are involved. That's the reason why I pick a symphony instead of a song, is because, you know, that was just my upbringing. Mm-hmm. It was that I would play the flute. I was, you know, I interned at a symphony growing up. I love being a part of that. And the Symphony of 1,000, Mahler Symphony Number 9, so many players involved, so many people, so much efforts involved to make it all come together. And so that music for me, you know, reminds me of the work that we do, in the sense that it takes so many of us, it requires all of us to make the work that we do effective for it to work. And so instead of a song, I would pick Symphony Mahler Number 9 as the music that resonates with me, that talks about the hard work that is involved and how important it is to make sure that we involve people in the process, and that when it all comes together, it is a beautiful piece of music.
No, that's beautiful. Fee, and thanks for sharing that. It brings us also to the end of our conversation today. I would like to really thank you for making time, for who you are, for what you do, and it's really always a pleasure, you know, listening to your stories. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Maurice. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on www.100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.